This morning we're looking at King David. David is strange in a lot of ways. We've been talking in our Wednesday night class, as we've been going through 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, we've been talking about some of the things that we see in David, some admirable things. But he doesn't do things in the way that you would expect things to be done a lot of times. Even when we first meet David, it's in an unexpected way. Right? If you remember, Samuel is sent to go meet the next anointed king of Israel. And he goes to Jesse's house and says, I'm here to anoint one of your sons. And he lines them all up, except for David, who's out in the fields because he's the youngest. And obviously, David's not going to be the choice. And he goes down the line of the oldest all the way down, and God just keeps saying, nope, there's another one. And then finally call David in, the little shepherd. And later, David goes into battle against a giant, right? And he does things in a strange way. Goliath seemed to expect somebody with a sword or a spear ready to go hand-to-hand combat. David comes up with a sling. And the battle is over very quickly. This week, when we are looking in 2 Samuel 9, we see another strange thing that David does. At this point, he's settled in as king. He has been recognized as king over all of Israel after a little bit of mess that we'll touch on in a little bit here. But Saul is dead. Saul's children are dead. And David's throne seems to be secure. In the beginning of chapter 9, David asks, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul? Now, if you stop there, this does not seem strange yet. It is not unusual for a king to seek out remaining members of the house of the preceding king. There's a reason to seek them out often. Tie up loose ends, right? Anyone still left who can claim to be of a kingly line might be a threat down the line. So the beginning of this sentence does not sound unusual. Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul? But he continues, to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake. Now we remember the friendship between David and Jonathan. And how Jonathan saved David's life. And because of that, at the very least, he wants to find remainder of Saul's household to show kindness. That's weird, I think. That's a strange thing. David was a very powerful man. And he was able to have things done if he wanted them done. And yet he knew that that there could still be threats, but he wasn't worrying about that. David said, go find me someone. And so they find the son of Jonathan. Grandson of Saul. This man named Mephibosheth. Great name. I remember in Bible class as a kid, my mom was the teacher. I learned about story about Mephibosheth. We practiced the name. And so I remember that. And Mephibosheth was lame. His feet were lame. And David went to go find Mephibosheth, the only remaining member of the house of Saul. And when he finds him, you go to verse 6 of chapter 9. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. And David said, "Mephibosheth, your servant," he replied. "Don't be afraid," David said to him. He probably was afraid. "For I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" And David, the king, summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, to him and said, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring him in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table." It's a strange thing. It's a nice story. This is one of the stories, I shared this, and I apologize to the Wednesday night class who've heard a little bit of this the last couple weeks, but I only apologize a little bit. I like this story. This is one of those stories that makes me really respect David and who he was. You know, when we think of individuals that we respect, individuals that we want to emulate, we often try to put ourselves in their shoes. We might try to say, would I do that? And there are some of the more famous David stories that I have a hard time doing that with. On the battlefield with Goliath, if you say, would you be praying to God? Yes, I would be praying very, very fervently to God. but I have a hard time putting myself in that place. Some of the military victories or on the run from Saul, a little bit hard to put myself in the place of David there. But when I think of this chapter, there is something very admirable about the desire to do kindness. I'm not in the place of David as a king. I don't have any worry of any descendants of predecessors having any desire to strike me down, right, Don? I have no worry of that. But but this idea of this desire to find somebody to do kindness to, oh, that resonates with me. The way that David looks at people in a different way, I can understand wanting that. That's something that I can aspire to. More so than trying to work on my sling work. I can see this as a quality of David that we each can aspire to. And it's consistent with David. He looked at people in a different way. He looked at people in a different way than would be expected, and perhaps a different way than people around him would want him to look at people. David seemed to have a respect for life and for the identity that he can see on people as being God's people. If we go into the previous week's readings, you see David acting strange again. You see David surprising the people around him. Saul has died. That should be good news for David. Saul has been trying to kill David for a while. Remember, show kindness because of Jonathan. Jonathan saved his life. He saved his life from Saul, right? David had been very consistent that even when he had the opportunity, he was not going to take Saul's life, because who is he to strike down God's anointed? But it would be very easy to look at it differently from David's perspective if an enemy had struck down Saul, as was the case. And so at the very beginning of 2 Samuel, a messenger comes to deliver the good news to David. Your enemy is dead. In fact, he is taking credit for it. There's this Amalekite man in 2 Samuel chapter 1 who claims to have been the one to kill Saul. Well, he saw at the end of 1 Samuel that may not have been accurate anyway. But he comes there expecting to be the bearer of good news and perhaps the recipient of some good news by being the one who killed the enemy of David. And David's response "Why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" He sees Saul and he doesn't see an enemy. He sees someone that God has blessed, that God has chosen, that God has made. He doesn't see it as good news that Saul has died. A few chapters later, Saul's son Ishbosheth, who has been a major thorn in David's side, he even sat as recognized as king over part of the kingdom for 2 years, according to 2 Samuel, while David was trying to take his place as anointed as king. Ishbosheth caused problems for David and tried to kill him. A supporter of David one night went into Ishbosheth's house, stabbed and killed him and cut off his head, taking it with them. They traveled all night to bring the head to David, thinking they have good news. You remember that guy who was trying to challenge you for the throne? Remember that guy that tried to kill you? I have taken care of that for you. Good news, right? David's different. And if it sounds familiar to the Saul scene, David saw the connection as well. In 2 Samuel 4, verse 9, he says, "As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of all this trouble? When a man told me Saul is dead and thought he was bringing me good news, I seized him and put him to death. That was the reward I gave for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house, in his own bed, should I not now demand his blood from your hand and rid the earth of you?" David does things differently. David views people differently. David was completely within his rights to view Ishbosheth as an enemy and have it taken care of. If someone threatens the king, that usually doesn't go well for that person. Down the line, David does this again. His own son, Absalom, has tried to kill him, runs him out of the palace, tries to take the throne, gathers up supporters, takes people loyal to David and turns them to his side, and says that Absalom should be king instead of David, and his father should be dead. I know we're getting ahead to next week's reading. I'll allow it. When Absalom is killed, crazy scene. You should read it this week. I'm not going to tell it. Absalom is killed. Two men want to be the ones to deliver the good news. One runs ahead, and the other guy who had been asking the general for permission to go tell the news, and the general was wise enough to say, he's not going to take this as good news. You don't want to be the one bringing this news. He said, no, I really want to tell. So he goes, runs ahead of him. So two guys come in to give this news, and they come to David, and both of them say the same thing. They both come to David to tell him, praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king. And both times his response was, is Absalom okay? David seemed incapable of identifying a man as his enemy. He wouldn't kill his enemies at times. He wouldn't rejoice at their death. And when it came to Absalom, it was not good news. And he mourned. David is a man who seeks to do kindness and resists the temptation to label someone as an enemy. And if someone has identified themselves as an enemy, he resists the temptation to celebrate at their downfall. I respect that. Even more than anything David did on a battlefield, this stands out to me as something honorable about David, and something we can learn. The truth is, we have a lot of voices around us trying to tell us that we have enemies. Somebody thinks differently than you, they're your enemy. Somebody disagrees with your approach on things, well, they only want harm for this world, this country, for you. I came across a poll by the Pew Research Center. This was done April and May of 2016, so about 2 years ago. And it was they're trying to find out some information about partisanship. That's a lovely word, right? And it gives us all nice thoughts. And they're asking people how they view people who identify with the opposite political party. And so they're asking, they give a list of descriptive words. And said, would you say that this person of the opposite party is, that this word describes them more than other Americans as a whole? Does that make sense? Said, would you say this, that, you know, they ask a Republican, is a Democrat more likely to be this than the rest of the country is? All right. And the top responses, among Republicans, at least 45% of the Republicans polled said that Democrats are more likely than other Americans to be closed-minded, immoral, and lazy. About half of people said that. Flip to the other side. The closed-minded is still at the top of the list. 70% of Democrats say that Republicans are more likely to be closed-minded than other Americans. And coming behind that is that they are dishonest and unintelligent. This survey said, asked feelings that members of the opposite party make you feel. And one that stood out to me is 70% of Democrats say that Republicans make them feel afraid. And 62% of the Republicans say the Democrats make them feel afraid. We have been taught, and it's in every corner, that if somebody is different than you, they are your enemy. Listen to the campaign pitches that are out there. How many of them actually say what they are for? They say, you should be afraid of my opponent. My opponent and all those people with them stand against the things that you're for. Right? Doesn't matter where you stand or where they stand. They want you to know, you should vote for me because my opponent is your enemy. And that pitch works, unfortunately. These numbers, remember I said they're from about 2 years ago? Do you think these numbers look better from the developments of the past 2 years? We are getting further apart. And if we can't look at our neighbor and see something other than enemy, if they disagree with us, what are we doing? This attitude crosses over to churches as well, and not just political standings within church, but we look at churches that are different, and when we want to turn somebody that does something different into our enemies. You know, it's kind of like was George Carlin said that anybody that drives slower than you is an idiot, and anybody who drives faster than you is a maniac. Right? When it comes to churches, anybody that doesn't do exactly what we're doing is either liberal or ultra conservative. Right? Those are the terms that almost always come out. We find ways to point out the differences and find ways to label these people as enemies. Was that what we were called out to be? As Christians, as those who wear the name of Christ as our identity, were we called to label our enemies and to make sure that they fall so that their failures can be our victories? We weren't called to make enemies. We were called to make disciples. We are not called to bring down those who stand against us. We are called to love them. We see in the way that David viewed people as somebody who, you know, David is famously the man after God's own heart. If someone is identified with the heart of God, they're looking for reasons to love someone, not reasons to hate or divide. I'm not looking forward to the next few months leading up to another election. I've had some conversations with many of you that you kind of feel the same way. I don't know how we change the conversation. I don't think it's just by voting in one party or out one party. We need to find a way to change the conversation. Change the way we look at people, perhaps. We're out of time. I don't have the time for the answer today. Maybe we can find a way to at least start it here. Maybe that'll be a project for the next few months for us. Because God loves our community. Reds and the blues. Any other label you want to put on it. And we need to do the same. And we need to figure out a way that we can change this conversation. So maybe we're speaking the language of David instead of the language of this current climate. So that's all. Just that. If there's anything you need this morning, let us know. If you need prayers, if you need to get something off your chest, if you need something off, out of your heart, we want to be here for you with that. We want to show that love no matter what. If this morning you need to respond to the gospel, to baptism, we are definitely here for that. If there's any way that we can try to live up to that call, that example of David, that identity of Christ, that love of God, let us know as we stand and sing.
Have thine affections been nailed to the cross.